and trying to destabilize the country by meddling in its affairs, its sovereign affairs, of course, referring to the recent protests.
With their recent accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Iran has significantly expanded their diplomatic cooperation with their non-Western allies. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
An incident that caused Iranians a great deal of agony. Iranian mourners took part in the funeral procession of the victims of the terror attack in the city of Izeh in floods of tears. In addition to expressing their deepest sympathy with families of the victims, the participants also voiced their support for the Islamic Republic amid the enemy's efforts to destabilize the country.
We have taken part in this funeral procession to send a message to the US and Israel. They must know that Iran is not alone. We support the leader of the Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation. They cannot sow division in Iran by killing civilians. We will be victorious.
My fellow countrymen and dear people of Izeh, be sure that the Islamic Republic is strong and will definitely take revenge for the blood that has been shed by all the cruel enemies who are servants of the criminal government of the United States.
Also, a number of high-ranking state and military officials attended the funeral, vowing to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice as soon as possible.
The perpetrators of this crime will be punished. A number of them have been arrested, while some others have been identified. Some of them attempted to flee the country through border crossings. However, they have been arrested. We will inform the Iranian nation about arresting the rest of the perpetrators in the coming days.
Officials say so far 11 individuals who've been involved in Izeh terrorist attack have been detained. Seven people, including a 9-year-old child and a woman, were killed, while 11 others were wounded after gunmen started shooting at people in the center of the city.
The terrorist attack was completely pre-planned. The terrorists broke the cameras across the city by shooting at them 24 hours prior to the attack. Then the next day, they opened fire at people at a crossroad from two directions. Their goal was to cause a massive bloodshed.
Rezaei said the enemies cannot turn Iran to another Syria or Lebanon by carrying out violent acts like the ones in Shah Cheragh, Isfahan, and Izeh.
Iranian officials have strongly condemned the recent terror attacks in the country. They say the enemies of the Islamic Republic have now resorted to armed terror attacks that target civilians because they have failed to advance their anti-Iran agenda through creating media hype. Mahdi Abbasian, Izeh, Khuzestan.
The trailer released on Thursday for the documentary movie From Tehran to Tirana is so powerful in its message about the MKO and its practices that it leaves no room for doubting why every defector that has managed to flee insists on calling it a cult where members are required to demonstrate complete devotion to its leader.
Ever since I joined the MKO in Iraq and I realized that they had lied about everything, I wanted to leave, but it was almost impossible. Finally, when we were relocated to Albania, I found the opportunity to escape. Many inside the camp are not as lucky as me.
The movie is inspired by a book of the same name written by a defector who managed to escape the camp two decades ago and who has dedicated his life to raising public awareness about the MKO.
Nejat NGO was founded by a number of defectors about 15 years ago. Our mission is to reunite families with their loved ones and help defectors escape. We also try to raise awareness about this cult and how they recruit people.
Leaving the camp is almost impossible. I was recruited when I was a prisoner of war in Iraq. I was told that they would help me go home. I later found out that Saddam had allowed this. And also I met members who had come to Camp Ashraf with false promises of employment or asylum in Western countries and brought into Iraq illegally. We were all asked to submit our passports and ID cards, which effectively trapped us there.
The movie also highlights the new methods of recruitment through social media platforms by the MKO's so-called keyboard warriors, a group of about 300 MKO members who run fake social media accounts.
Parents should be very careful. They are now using new methods to recruit the younger generation. They ask these young people to go out on the streets and take part in riots and send them pictures and videos.
This is not the first time the MKO is using social media to advance its agenda. Previous reports by other TV channels has also revealed their strategy.
Should comment by the different account and not MKO members, Mujahideen, because we want to show the Iranian people support Maryam Rajavi.
So you were a troll?
Yes.
You were an internet troll?
Yes.
The Mujahideen Khalq organization, or the MKO, is a known terrorist organization. It has killed more than 17,000 Iranians over the past 43 years, and now it is actively involved in riots in Iran by instigating the younger generation through social media to carry out acts of vandalism. The best way to counter this terrorist organization is to raise public awareness, and this is the main focus of the movie. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Transfixed, ordinary Britons stand glued to their screens, waiting for the news to sink in. After weeks of will he not, the UK's new chancellor has announced his economic plan for the country. Except for a couple of surprise rabbits out of the hat, such as a bit of more spending in the health and education sectors, it was what everyone had expected. Tax hikes and spending cuts aimed at plugging a nearly $65 billion hole in public finances created by the previous Conservative government only 2 months ago. Pretty soon, millions of Britons will be paying more taxes. A freeze on the non-taxable part of their income will mean millions will be dragged into higher tax brackets, and the cap on energy bills introduced by the previous government will be scaled back as of April next year. As if that wasn't enough, Britons are going to see public sector spending cuts to the tune of $30 billion. All this as the country grapples with double-digit inflation, rising energy costs, and a prolonged recession, none of which was lost on the opposition.
What does this mean? Family holidays cancelled.
Yeah, yeah.
Savings depleted.
Yeah.
Hopes for the future replaced by sleepless nights.
Yeah.
And all of this on top of the fact that the average worker is earning less today than when the Tories came to power 12 years ago. The government has presided over the biggest wage squeeze in centuries.
Yeah.
This was a crisis made in Downing Street,
yeah.
And it is ordinary working people who are paying the price.
As ever, the Chancellor, as did the PM before him, blamed Britain's economic woes on the pandemic and external factors such as the war in Ukraine. But many experts say that's not all.
There are international factors. However, Britain has managed to achieve something on its own for one or two areas, such as the impact of Brexit. When they were in the EU, they had access to the world's largest free trade area. Britain deliberately took itself out of that and hasn't been able to replace it with anything. So that's had extra costs to it. And so there's also been less confidence in Britain because it's outside that. Why should I be investing? And so if it's not seen to be as really secure and full of confidence, then investors will go elsewhere. And that's what we've been seeing.
Despite the government saying its measures announced today are necessary for balancing the books, there is no doubt that they will have real consequences for millions of Britons for years to come. Saipur is up, London.
The Taliban's Ministry of Vice and Virtue have banned Afghan women from visiting all parks, using gyms and public baths.
Recently, women are banned from going to parks, sports clubs, and public baths by the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. For the past 15 months, the orders given to these places were violated and ignored. That's why now it is decided that they should be banned. It is not clear how long the restrictions would last or whether they are going to be lifted.
The famous city park in Kabul, once filled with families' joy and laughter, now has turned idle and silent, with only a handful of men wandering through the complex. The ban order has also affected the livelihoods of people who have been making ends meet by working at public places.
They are interrupting our livelihoods with their decisions. Now they have banned women, so less customers are visiting here. Look, it's in the middle of the day, but no visitors. I have rented a photography shop here, and I used to have an adequate income. But now the ban is making me close it down.
Women's rights activists urge the Taliban to reverse its course on all women's rights, saying such decisions would provoke national outrage.
Instead of attempting to ban the doors of parks for women, the Taliban should manage to let Afghan boys and girls learn. They should address the economic and humanitarian crisis in the country rather than focusing on weird restrictions on women. I'm sure such decisions expose the reality of the Taliban and would face public anger.
The Taliban have already banned women from traveling without a male relative. Secondary schools for girls have also been shut for over a year across the country. Afghan women are worried about being barred from public places after the authorities announced the new restrictions. The women are now calling for justice, demanding the authorities protect their rights. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Shah-e-Dharab, a week-long exhibition in Indian-administered Kashmir is displaying dozens of rare manuscripts written by prominent poet Khwaja Muhammad Amin Dharab. The language was once officially used in courts and commerce until 1889. The organizers say the aim of the event is to revive Persian language in the region. About 73 manuscripts, including a dozen books written by Dharab, are on display.
Persian is so deeply entrenched that you can't think of a craft without Persian. You can't think of Kashmiri language, forget about Persian, without Persian language. You can't think of our basic ethical and sacred knowledge without Persian.
Persian is what Kashmir is all about. And it still has a resonance in contemporary Kashmiri society. If you go to any urs or any major shrine of Kashmir, the manqabat and the naats that are recited will be jami. They will be in Persian.
Chronogram on Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon, Maharaja of Kashmir's accession to the throne in 1923, elegies of prominent scholars, including on the death of Muslim scholar and jurist Maulana Anwar Shah Kashmiri, are being displayed in the exhibition. Dharab was instrumental in transmitting traditional Persian literature in the region. He is also known as a master of Kitah-e-Tarikh and Naats in the praise of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Dharab died in 1979 in Srinagar, but his memories and writings continue to enlighten hearts and minds in the region. The remnants of Persian verses are widely recited in mosques, shrines, Sufi and spiritual gatherings. The Persian language reached its peak in Kashmir during the Mughal rule, but faded with the course of time. The exhibition organizers say events like this are an ideal platform to revive Persian language and literature.
I want people to know what he has written, because if you keep it in boxes, nobody would know. Maybe the language is not here anymore, but the language never dies. See, even now some people are so interested in it, that's why we are getting a good response. And there is so much of culture in this language, there is so much of history about Kashmir as well in the language, because it's somehow connected with Iran.
Organizers say Dharab's contribution to Persian literature in the valley is also highlighted in documentation of the greatest poets, Ghani Kashmiri. Munawar Zaman, Indian-administered Kashmir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to Thee, to be joyful in worshipping Thee, to be desirous of Thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me Thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom Thou wilt.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The IAEA, a UN agency, has once again shown that it is acting on a political capacity rather than a technical one. At least that's the view from Iran. The IAEA Board of Governors adopted a politically motivated anti-Tehran resolution on a country that has the most transparent, peaceful nuclear program. Does this act deserve a countermeasure that Iran at this point is contemplating? Should it involve the level of cooperation with the IAEA? If Iran does decide to take that route, wouldn't that jeopardize Iran's membership at the NPT, or has Iran not reaped the benefits of being an NPT member? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce them. Don DeBar is an activist and commentator, joining us from Ossining, New York. Also joining us is John Busnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, who joins us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start with you, John Busnich, taking a look at this anti-Iran IAEA resolution. It's not in the best spirit of cooperation, to say the least. It's brought forward by the U.S. and the E3, namely Germany and France, part of the E3. And also, it has censored Iran over insufficient cooperation. What do you make of another resolution that it has leveled against Iran, given the sensitivity, obviously, of the whole picture and the whole matter here?
It only looks worse and worse. This is a trend of behavior that we've been seeing for years against Iran. And that is obviously because of the Israeli lobby and its influence on the American government and on the American personnel inside the IAEA. This does not look good. It looks like yet another provocation to create a false grounds for aggressive action against Iran.
What kind of aggressive action do you think?
Well, you know, when we're talking about the United States in this day and age, especially with a warmonger like Joseph Biden in power, anything is on the table. And the slightest provocation that they can invent, such as the latest provocation that they used in Ukraine about so-called Russian missiles landing in Poland, they can invent any excuse that they want. They just use the IAEA to make it a little bit more believable to those naive people around the world who still trust in such institutions.
Dunbar, what do you think about the timing of the resolution being passed at this point?
Well, right, it's the 17th of November, right, which is last Thursday or Wednesday, whatever. Isn't that the same day that the rocket landed in Poland, or the day following the rocket landing in Poland? It's very interesting that we're discussing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty at this moment, and Iran as the great offender, as opposed to, let's say, for example, the United States. In 1970, when the treaty was put together, it was envisioned, and in fact, was written into the body of it, that there would be a disarmament at some point in the not-so-distant future. You know, that's been 52 years now. The United States only at the last year of the Obama administration, so 5 years ago, actually budgeted to spend $1 trillion on nuclear weapons. And the language of the history of the law of this thing is interesting also. I'll try not to be too lengthy with this, but there was an advisory opinion that was requested by the World Health Organization back in the 90s that came out of the International Court of Justice. It issued on July 8th of 1996, asking a number of questions about the legality of using the threat of nuclear war as a deterrence, or actually using nuclear weapons and under which conditions, et cetera, would it be legal or illegal? You know, as absurd as this sounds, like once they blow the world up, who cares if it was a code violation? But the questions were entertained by the court. And one particular question was the one that was divisive. You had 14 judges from 14 different countries, and they split 7-7 on one question. And that is it legal to use nuclear weapons in the event that the very existence of the state is threatened? The United States and its allies, Japan, Germany, etc., voted that it is not legal to do so. Russia, China, and some others voted that, yes, it is legal to do so. In other words, these weapons can be used if you try to take down our state, our government, and the United States disagrees. This is very important at this moment right now, because while these people are trying to enable the United States to perpetuate sanctions and all kinds of other warfare against Iran, the actual threat of nuclear war exists and is being stoked by the United States on a daily basis in Ukraine. And the question about whether or not Russia, if the Russian state were taken down, as the United States has been trying to do since this war started, like it's trying to do to Iran also with sanctions and everything else, that it would Russia then be entitled to use nuclear weapons? And they've said our doctrine includes two cases where we'll use them, which is in total compliance with the ICJ's ruling. One, in the event of a nuclear attack on us, and two, in the event that you do something to us that threatens the survival of our state.
Sure.
And that question is something that should be entertained by the IAEA and the International Court of Justice and whatever else is going on anywhere else in the world today, while the possibility of nuclear war is a very real threat.
Well, the IAEA, John Busnich, as Iran sees it, is not acting in a technical capacity, but rather it's been influenced, for example, by Israel, as you, I think, mentioned, and also just influenced by political matters that are then leading to the consequential direction given by the U.S. and the E3 consequentially. But at this point, the timing is also something that needs to be discussed. Before we get into that, though, it seems like there is some kind of schism, some kind of uncertainty, unless it's by design, that's coming from the U.S. in particular. Just recently, the Pentagon's new nuclear posture review, the NPR, actually came out and said that the U.S. believes that Iran is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. But at the same time, you have the U.S. President Joe Biden and his administration still threatening military action against Tehran, which they say is to prevent it from acquiring one. Those two don't go together, do they?
They don't go together at all. And I think you came across the correct point that the IAEA is not just being influenced by the Israel lobby and by the U.S. government. The IAEA has become a primary instrument of pre-aggression. In other words, they create the scenario, they make the false charges, they do not prove the charges, and then they use the false, unproven charges to stoke the fires of aggression against you. And once these fires of aggression are lit, then Israel can act unilaterally, illegally, of course. America can act unilaterally, illegally, of course, and just say that, well, the IAEA already reported that this was happening, and we simply couldn't wait for the inefficient United Nations to take any action. And that is the formula for aggression. And I have to say that Iran, as I've said through all of these discussions on this topic, must be ready for the worst. That's what it is.
Okay, well, if Iran has to be ready for the worst, Don DeBar, at the same time, it is doing what it can under the guidelines, as an NPT member, and has presented itself as having the most peaceful nuclear program in terms of the number of facilities, et cetera, but also has provided the means for the IAEA to exercise the most intense inspection regime ever in its history. So if it's not reaping the rewards of that cooperation, what would you do if you were Iran?
I mean, it's very difficult to imagine that they could do any more to assuage the concerns of the world about their nuclear weapons program. In a state that the world refers to as a theocratic state, the highest religious officials have said that this is something that we are not allowed to do by our faith. And then in terms of the study of the science of developing these weapons, you open your facilities to these people for years in a way that no other nation has done. No one. I mean, compare and contrast the access that the IAEA and even like the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN, you know, and a host of others have had to the laboratories in Iran with the access that was provided to the biowarfare laboratories that the U.S. operated in Ukraine. I mean, what exactly are we talking about? We have the United States with, again, $1 trillion worth of just nuclear weapons and an annual military budget on the books of $750 billion every year for as far back as I can remember, and the military force assembled by that, pointed at the whole world, occupying more than half the world physically, threatening nuclear devastation of the entire planet, physically, in actuality. We have the weapons, okay? And then looking at Iran, who might possibly have touched some material that turned into UO2 or something, and there's 3 grains of it over here, maybe, or might have been on somebody's shoe when they came to inspect. And that is the big catastrophe facing the world right now. Iran, who's never invaded anyone, is a threat with nuclear weapons that they don't have, and being accused by the biggest bully on the block, who is in the middle of destroying, at the moment, at least 7 nations.
That's true. Well, my approach here is testing through my questions to both of you the patience that Iran has displayed or should not display anymore. Again, that's up to you to analyze. John Busnich, coming at another through another angle on this, we're looking at acts of sabotage that Iran has experienced, from its nuclear scientists that have been assassinated to the most recent, as far as I recall, the Karaj nuclear facility that was sabotaged, where not even a condemnation, which Iran asked the UN agency, the IAEA, to actually come out and voice, did the IAEA do. Why would the IAEA not even come out and condemn what was an apparent act of sabotage? It was very obvious, and yet it refrained from doing that. Why do you think that is?
Each of these examples are just a reinforcement of the general thesis that I've put forward here, that the IAEA is nothing of the sort. The IAEA is a spying organization which only spies on enemies of the United States and Israel. I would suggest that the only way to shut these liars up is to relocate the headquarters of the IAEA inside Iran, inside your nuclear facilities, and wait until Israel or America tries to make a sneak attack to bomb them. And when they kill the IAEA inspectors themselves, then the world will know what's what, because you've provided video, you've provided physical monitoring, you've provided other monitoring from the sky, from satellites, and nothing works, because the lies perpetrated by the lying mainstream media are bigger to the common person's eye than the truth.
The Israeli influence on the IAEA has been stated time and again, and there's plenty of material out there. But nowhere was it so displayed so ostentatiously, Don DeBar, was when the resolution, which happened on June 8th by the Board of Governors, was issued. And just weeks before, you had Rafael Grossi make a controversial visit, as it was called, to Israel. And then, of course, we come out from that, and then you have that resolution issued. Again, what would Iran and should Iran view that to be? This visit to Israel and then having a resolution to be issued against Iran.
Well, it's a part of a whole cloth. You know, there's the history of Israel illegally making military attacks on Iran's facilities. Illegal, under international law. Never disciplined. Not you can't even bring it up at the Security Council. The U.S., France, U.K. immediately veto it before it gets out of your mouth. You have, of course, Wesley Clark's list, okay, of the seven countries that the U.S. was going to take down, and Iran was prominent on the list. You also have the term that was invented for Israel of nuclear ambiguity. No one else in the world is allowed to be ambiguous about nuclear weapons except Israel. You know, that speaks volumes in my book. This is in the center of, you know, this cauldron, as they term it, of the Middle East, with all the warfare that goes on there, mostly brought in from the outside by the U.S. The other former colonial powers, the now puppet colonial powers. In addition to that, by the way, Israel being the only one that has conducted a genocide in that region of the people, the indigenous people there, which is ongoing, by the way. The whole world knows it. It's an open secret. You're not allowed to say it out loud. But there's been a genocide conducted by Europeans in the Middle East on the land that was called Palestine, that contains people that are still called Palestinians, those that are left. And this is the power that has allowed nuclear ambiguity in the middle of the region, while Iran, who was never invaded anyone and has a civilization sitting on that land going back a few thousand years, is the great danger to the neighborhood. It strains. I don't know. I don't have words.
Well, we were looking at the JCPOA revival talks, which are also called sanctions removal talks, to have made progress or to have digressed. It was back and forth, in a sense, in the past months. And then you had what has happened in the past 2 months, of which the Iranian government, the spokesperson, has reacted to it, and that's the rioting that has taken place in some parts of Iran. And without saying it outright, it did make references to the point that the E3 and the U.S. are trying to take advantage of that situation and then forward that resolution to the Board of Governors in order for it to then be issued against Iran. Do you think that is maybe one of the driving factors behind the resolution?
Okay. Well, obviously, yes, it is. Obviously, the entire situation of these renewed demands of inspections is a setup. Obviously, Iran is being led down the garden path by performing what it's being asked to do and then being condemned for not having done what it did in front of inspectors. This is a lie so big that one has, I mean, as an individual who grew up on the border of the United States in Canada, in a so-called democracy, when I see this and the mistreatment of Iran, it makes me wonder about every single guiding principle we were taught in school as children. Everything we lived through and everything they taught us appears to be a lie. This is today's world, and it's a real pity that individuals like myself, who were raised in the West and educated in the West and excelled in their system, find ourselves ostracized from the regimes that created our own mentality because they lie too much for us to believe a single word that they say.
I got to address that same question to you, Don DeBar, and to use the words of the Iran spokesperson. He said the U.S. and EU are trying to, quote, take advantage of recent conditions strictly with the motivation and the goal of exerting political pressure on Iran. Again, without mentioning the rioting that was taking place. Your reaction to that? And also, how can Iran trust the parties to, at this point, it's not even, I'm not even sure if there is anything in the works. But if there were to be a deal, how could Iran trust those parties when they have reacted the way they have throughout this whole time, in terms of all the different, not only resolutions, but the way they've treated Iran inconsistently and questioning Iran's sincerity when it comes to its operations?
Well, let me answer the original question first, please. It's important to note something, okay? Look at these, basically, the wars that were being conducted still, against Libya and Syria, and contrast them. They were able to knock down the regime, the government, the state in Libya and not in Syria. And the decisive factor, really, was air power. The enabling resolutions, 1970 and 1973 in the United Nations regarding Libya, enabled, whether allowed or not, but enabled and brought a 8-month or 7-month, whatever, daily air bombardment campaign in conjunction with the terrorist attacks on the ground. In Syria, because Russia and China repeatedly vetoed resolutions that would have enabled an air attack in Syria, the government was able to buy time, and then Russia came in and provided air support. And so the Syrian state is actually stable. If under siege, it's still stable. When you see a situation like you've experienced in Iran recently unrolled, and this is another wave of what they did after the election 10 or 12 years ago, you know that this is the U.S. government attacking. And the activity that we're seeing coordinate with that at the IAEA, clearly, in my mind, is intended to provide some raison for an aerial attack that can operate in coordination with the ground attack that's failed. And so I think you have to consider that as an organic whole when you're looking at these things and consider that defenses should be raised in that manner. I'm no military strategist, but looking at what has happened and what's unfolding here, that seems obvious to me. With respect to, what was the second part of the question? I'm sorry.
The second part was, how could Iran trust these parties if there's a possibility of a deal at all, even in the works right now? That's something after all this time. And that's something that happened with the previous, when the JCPOA was signed, of course, the different areas where they failed Iran in many respects. And it wasn't even a takeoff from the ground when the JCPOA was enacted. But the issue of trust.
All right, well, across the table from Iran, who you're supposed to trust are basically the architects of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and consequently its child, the IAEA. That treaty was developed, sold, adopted around the world on the claim that, A, it would stop the spread of nuclear weapons from the states. There were five primary states, the same ones that are on the Security Council, and four or five others. India, Pakistan, et cetera, that would be it. And nuclear weapons were going to sunset sometime in the not-too-distant future. They would be gone. The scourge would be gone. Well, obviously they haven't, and the United States, again, just spent $1 trillion upgrading theirs, recently. And in addition to that, the United States developed this doctrine, I don't know what else you could call this, scam, of saying, well, if we are occupying Poland, for example, or Germany or somewhere else, and we bring our nuclear weapons in there and base them in that country, that's not really proliferation.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so that's what you're sitting across the table from. You can't trust them at all. How did the JCPOA work out?
Right, indeed. Well, John Busnish, last question to you since we're out of time. Just to be clear, Director of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Dr. Mohammad Islami, has said that Iran not only will give a firm response, but it has also said that he will continue his peaceful nuclear program. So in that case, we want to be clear, which is in compliance with his international obligations. Is the U.S. trying to take advantage of the situation currently happening in Iran to use that as not a barter, but a means for negotiations, because it is still interested in making this thing work, do you think?
Look, as a former head of state advisor, I can tell you that the current situation in Iran is a situation that the United States is provoking at the same time. U.S. agents are working inside your country right now to provoke protests. Whatever grievance there might have been, it has been amplified by the U.S. State Department and by the CIA inside your country already. So you can take it this way. They are attacking you on the IAEA side. They are attacking you by organizing protests expansion inside your country, and they will definitely try new tactics. As I've always said, the only protection against American militarism and unilateralism is to tie up with other countries that are threatened by the same thing.
Thank you so much,
That's
John Busnish, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Don DeBar, pleasure. activist and commentator from Austin, New York. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikavi Tatwe and the team, it's goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts say the United States remains the number one arms exporting nation on the planet. This country likes tension in the world because it feeds on the tension. By stoking tension between countries and regions around the world and selling arms to the conflicting parts, the U.S. regime fills the pockets of the military-industrial complex. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The website of Truth Out noted, while the humanitarian consequences of U.S. arms sales may be devastating, if you happen to be a major weapons maker like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, or General Dynamics, the economic benefits are enormous. Weapon systems built by those four companies alone have figured in more than half of the $100 billion-plus dollars in major arms offers made since President Biden took office. While those firms prefer to pose as passive beneficiaries of carefully considered government policies, they continue to work overtime to loosen restrictions on weapons exports and expand the number of countries eligible for such equipment and training. To that end, those four giant firms alone routinely donate millions of dollars to key members of Congress while employing 300 lobbyists, many of them drawn from the ranks of the Pentagon, Congress, and the National Security Council. Once on board, those retired generals, admirals, and other officials use their government contacts and inside knowledge of the arms sales process to influence government policies and practices. particularly egregious and visible example of this was Raytheon's effort to pressure Congress and the Trump administration to approve a sale of precision-guided munitions to the Saudis. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked inside the State Department to keep the Saudi arm pipeline open, despite that country's bombing of civilian targets in Yemen, and then Raytheon's former CEO, Thomas Kennedy, even went so far as to directly lobby Senate Foreign Relations Chairman Senator Rob Menendez over Saudi arms sales. He was rebuffed. But the most spectacular lobbyist for the Saudi was, of course, Trump, who justified continuing arms sales to Riyadh after the regime's 2018 murder of U.S. resident, Saudi journalist, and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi this way. $110 billion will be spent on the purchase of military equipment from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and many other great U.S. defense contractors. If we foolishly cancel these contracts, Russia and China would be enormous beneficiaries and very happy to acquire all this newfound business. It would be a wonderful gift to them directly from the United States, he said. In fact, neither Russia nor China would be able to replace the U.S. as Saudi Arabia's primary arms supplier anytime soon. The kingdom is so reliant on American equipment that it might take a decade or more for it to rebuild its military around weapons supplied by another nation. In reality, expensive as American arms sales to the Saudi are, that $110 billion figure was a typical case of Trumpian exaggeration. Actual sales during his term were less than one-third of that, and jobs tied to those sales in the U.S. were similarly far less than President Trump claimed. The figure he liked to throw around, 500,000, was at least 12 times the actual one. Still, the damage done by the weaponry his administration rammed through Congress for the Saudis has been incalculable and can't be measured by the dollar value of any particular sale. The Raytheon lobbying campaign was extraordinary primarily because its details became public knowledge, but count on one thing. Similar efforts by other military-industrial corporations surely take place behind closed doors on a regular basis. One precondition for reducing dangerous arms deals would have to be reducing the political power of the major weapons-producing companies. Also, responsible statecraft wrote, U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released late last week by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war in the past two decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report. Secret war, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But this list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author Catherine Yon Ebright wrote in the introduction, this proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and very dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.